Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Ruby Rogues podcast. This week on our panel, we have Luke Stutters.
Hello.
John Epperson.
Hello, everybody.
Now, I set the topic this week, and it was something that I kind of been thinking about a little bit since we did a similar episode on JavaScript Jabber. And people have really actually been enjoying it. So on JavaScript Jabber, Dan Shapir, who's one of our panelists over there, we did like two episodes of what are the things that JavaScript developers need to know? And I thought, oh, this is perfect. Let's do this for Ruby, right? What are the things that Rubyists need to know? So generally, it was mostly kind of the fundamentals, right? What are the fundamental things that Rubyists need to understand in order to be competent Rubyists, right? And when we were getting started, John, you asked a question that was essentially, is this for like mid-level people or beginners? And it's kind of for everybody in the sense that if you don't understand these things, and I've kind of got a list in my head, I didn't get a chance to write them all down. But if you don't understand these things, then you're going to at some point wish you had, right? And so for the mid-level folks, it's going to be, you know, stuff that you probably know most of, and you probably ought to bone up on the rest. For new people, you're going to know some of it, right? Because you went through boot camp or what have you, and you're going to need to learn the rest. And for senior folks, it might be good to go review some of this stuff, is kind of how I see it. So it's stuff that people are going to need to know one way or the other. So that's kind of where I'm coming down. Did you work your tail off to get that senior developer gig just to realize that senior dev doesn't actually mean dream job? I've been there too. My first senior developer job was at a place where all of our triumphs were the bosses and all the failures were ours. The second one was a great place to continue to learn and grow, only for it to go under due to poor management. And now I get job offers from great places to work all the time. Not only that, but the last job interview I actually sat in was a discussion about how much my podcast had helped the people interviewing me. If you're looking for a way to get into your dream job, then join our Dev Heroes Accelerator. Not only will we help you get the kind of exposure that makes you attractive to your dream employer, but you'll be able to ask them for top dollar as well. Check it out at devheroesaccelerator.com. And I'm a little curious before I kind of get into some of the things that I have in my head. Are there areas that you feel like kind of come to your mind just off the top of your head or maybe in the last few minutes since the topic was brought up? Metaprogramming.
Metaprogramming is the killer of beginner Ruby developers.
Repos. I agree. There's a lot of double-edged swords in Ruby. I think this is a good topic for us to like talk about. Like, it's totally a double-edged sword. It's a very powerful tool that you can cut your own hand off with, right? And there's tons of those in Ruby. And I think that knowing a lot of those and understanding why you would want to use it and why you wouldn't want to use it is absolutely valuable, in my opinion. I agree with you, Luke.
Okay. So I agree with John. This is something that gets people into trouble. But it's also very, very handy, right? So I guess maybe we should get a little more specific as far as not just what they need to know about it, but what they need to know about when to use it, when not to use it, I guess.
Specific for beginner developers, having lived this life experience. So I've done a whole load of coding before university and elsewhere. You start working for a company, it's a Ruby on Rails shop. Maybe you haven't touched Ruby on Rails before, and something's on fire and you have to fix it, or there's something that no one's, you're the first person to look at this. Maybe the old developers left and you picked it up, and this is your introduction to Ruby on Rails. Yeah. If there is a function or method name in Rails, you cannot find it through text search every time. So when you see a method call, a function call in Ruby, that a string may not exist in any other part of a code base because it's metaprogrammed. So you cannot trace the path of execution like you can in nearly every other language just through a text search.
Oh, interesting. I hadn't even thought of it that way. I'm sitting there going, why would a new person have to do metaprogramming? But it's not so that you can do it. It's so that you can understand the shortcuts that somebody else took or understand the powerful features they used to implement something that they couldn't, I guess, completely define, right? So Rails does this, for example, right? So you give it attributes or you give it relations, right? You tell it has many or belongs to, right? And that's all metaprogrammed on the other end, right? Rails does all that magic. And So understanding metaprogramming will help you figure out where that's implemented because you're not going to find it any other way. Is that an example of what you're talking about, Luke?
It, and of course, the Rails MVC pattern is not the same as an MVC pattern in other languages. There are subtle differences. So even if you're looking in roughly the right place, so you're searching the controller, it may very well be in the method. So this is what burned me early on in my Rails adventures, was just getting really frustrated because look, I can see I'm good up to this point, and then I simply don't know where the code goes. And when you're a beginner developer, you're just starting out, then people say, oh, yeah, you can just put a breakpoint in there, right? You can just kind of jump in. You won't know how to do that. If you're starting a language, you just won't know how to do that. So once you do learn those tools, the IRB is the prize of Ruby, or get yourself a GUI, you can set breakpoints, you can start debugging. But before then, unless you realize that there's a lot of metaprogramming going on, and that's kind of like the big deal about Ruby is how easy and how powerful it is, you're going to have a tough time.
So I'm completely on the same page here. Like, yep. It's, I tend to simplify it a little bit when I like tell, so occasionally people are like, well, should I or shouldn't use metaprogramming? And I feel like my thumb rule or whatever, rule of thumb, there we go. Wow, couldn't even remember the expression, is just, you know, you definitely need to know how to read it. Like, you need to know how to find things that you don't know where they are. And sometimes that means that you need to know, like, hopefully, if you're working as a team, right, you have an idea of who might have that knowledge, right? Because maybe it's not documented or something, and you can go ask them where to find stuff. So, you know, being able to find stuff is one important aspect. Being able to read it when it's right in front of you and understand, you know, when you're reading the few lines that create that metaprogramming, right? You definitely need to be familiar with method missing. You should be familiar with...
Those are the two magic words. And I can't tell you how long I did Ruby coding before knowing those two words either. That was a bit of a baptism of fire.
What, method missing?
Method missing is the big one, right? That'll take like 70% of metaprogramming things, you know, or help you figure out 70% of metaprogramming things. You know, there's a lot of things that are sort of, you know, related. Understanding send, understanding a lot of like the class level helpers, like adder accessible, writers and readers, you know, all of those things like are often used around the metaprogramming space, and understanding like those class level things will kind of help you just understand a lot of that stuff. But yeah, if you can read it, you're in good shape. And then when you're in a sticky spot and you're trying to decide if you should or shouldn't metaprogram, you know, for the most part, like if you're trying to make that decision and you're thinking really hard about it, the answer is no, because that means that somebody coming behind you won't know either, right?
Right.
Metaprogramming, I
thank
feel
you for
like,
saying that.
I feel like if you're struggling to decide, the answer is no. If you'll get to a place, you may get to a place where you're just like, this really seemed like an obvious choice to metaprogram because I, you know, am writing one method that does, I'm actually doing work one time and I'm repeating it 20 times. So this seems like an obvious metaprogramming thing. And then, you know, it's sort of your job to make it really easy for the person coming after you to find that. I mean, that can be hard. So I feel like you should use metaprogramming sparingly. It's super powerful when you need it. But just like macros, you know, and other like metaprogramming techniques from other languages, right? Like the metaprogramming is difficult to think about. It's difficult to document. It's just difficult for people to understand naturally. And it doesn't read well. And people use Ruby because it's easy to read. So it kind of goes against the normal flow. So you gotta use it kind of sparingly. That's how I tell people.
Yeah. One other thing that I'm just going to throw in there is the method missing approach, right, that we're talking about here. Essentially what it does is it picks up when there's not a method on an instance of a class, and it says, do this stuff with it, right? And usually there's a super call in there that says, and then if none of these apply, right, then go ahead and, you know, raise the exception that says that method doesn't exist. But there's the respond to method, which is kind of the counterpart to knowing if your instance is going to respond to a particular method call, right? And what I see often is people will implement method missing and then they will forget to patch respond to. And so then you have, I was going to say instances, but that gets confusing. But you will find yourself in a scenario now where because of method missing, your instance will respond to a method call that respond to doesn't actually give you the right answer for. And so there are all of these gotchas that you can run into. And so to that degree, it kind of gets into advanced magic, I think, as far as implementing it goes. But yeah, I completely agree when it comes down to reading it and understanding it and being able to follow where the code goes, especially the libraries take advantage of it all the time because they have to code around the parts of the stuff that you're going to care about that they can't account for. And so that's where you're going to get into it.
I mean, confession to make, I recently fell off the meta programming bandwagon. I've been clean for a number of years, but I did implement some method programming. Fortunately, it wasn't method missing, but it was dynamic building of objects such that you couldn't easily trace. And I was kind of writing my own mini framework. And I realized that I didn't want to have to type the same stuff into all of these classes and the inheritance. It was no way to, nice way to do it. So I did write something to kind of dynamically build classes. And I felt bad about it. I did, but it removed like hundreds of lines from my code. So there we go. That's my confession. I promise never to do it again. What I will say is, having worked with beginner Ruby developers in different countries and evangelized Ruby in companies that haven't used it, especially in countries with English as a second language, people who have limited programming experience do really well with Ruby up until the point when you start introducing these features. So in situations where I couldn't quite understand what the client needed, and I want business logic was often finance related and precise, then I could give them a simple Ruby environment and they would be away. They would code that thing, you know, and they'd say, wow, this is fantastic. But as soon as they jumped into, like I said, the flow control, how the rest of it worked, then they kind of hit a brick wall. And I found it really, really difficult to explain. So the it's very powerful, but that's why I tend to avoid it, because it makes much more difficult to hand off your projects to new developers.
Yeah. Now, I kind of want to move into a different thing that we've kind of flirted with the metaprogramming. And usually when we're doing metaprogramming, we are trying to get around some deficiency that inheritance isn't a good option for. And this is another one of those things that I really feel like Rubyists need to understand. And when I say inheritance, I don't just mean like the, you know, this class inherits from this other class. What I also mean is module composition, right? Because essentially what module composition, when you include a module into a class, it just modifies the inheritance chain on the class. And so you have to understand the lookup procedure within Ruby to understand why it's going to pull this version of that method, not the other. And so
that's very true.
That'll get you into trouble too. And yeah, usually when people reach for metaprogramming, they're reaching for something that they couldn't solve with inheritance, in my experience.
I was going to argue, especially since we just got prepended a couple of versions. It's not a couple now, but a few versions of Ruby ago, right? So now that we have, you know, both inclusion and prepension, I guess, I don't actually know if that's a word.
Ooh, say that about six times. I like hearing it.
Prepension. It's now a thing.
Sounds kind of pretentious to me. Anyway.
That's a different word altogether. So now that we have that, right? Like now you have to be, I think the inclusion was difficult enough of a concept, I feel like, for a lot of people to really understand. And people just thought that I don't know. I encounter a lot of people who kind of think about it as if it's the same thing, sort of, right, as inheritance, which there are some elements of it to it, right, which can act that way, right? Like, you know, mm-hmm. like you said, you're adding it to your ancestor chain, things like that. But inclusion directly modifies, you know, an instance of a class at runtime, right? So there's not everything, it's order dependent a yes. little bit more than, I guess, technically, okay, hold on. The where you include in your class is order dependent. You know, your class, I guess, inheritance is order dependent too, I guess, if you know you have a parent and child out of order or whatever. Mm-hmm. But yeah, a lot of this stuff all requires correct ordering and understanding where So I guess the thing that I'm getting at is understanding how each thing and at what time each thing gets affected, or each, you know, class or instance of a class gets affected by these things, is very important, so that you can choose which tool to use. Or, you know, for example, should I be using, you know, should I include something? Should I do something when I get included? Or should I just put it in my module itself? Like, do I care about modifying the class instance, or am I modifying the instance? And I'm trying to use those words carefully. I know that's confusing, right? So there can be an instance of a class, to be clear, and that's what you're mostly working with, right? So for example, in Rails, right? An individual record is going to be an instance of a model, but maybe I want to modify the user class, for example, and have things that are shared by all users. So I'm modifying the class instance versus an instance of the class. Anyway, understanding, and I totally had this on my list, right? Understanding the elements of OOP, which I kind of think that modules are kind of extending that, right? So modules also bring in some outside, some non-OOP things to Ruby. But understanding OOP, I think, is like fundamental, because Ruby is at its core a purely OOP language. Like, it implements all of the elements of OOP that we know in some form or fashion, and it brings some really cool stuff to OOP. Actually, that's not really true. Smalltalk brings cool stuff to OOP that Ruby copied.
Welcome to programming.
Yeah.
We so stole all the good stuff.
Learn everything when you program in Smalltalk or Ruby, and then you want to go back to something like C++ or Java, which are like earlier, you know, OOP languages. You're just completely confounded by how much harder it is to write OOP over there. And you're like, well, there's features over here in Ruby that I'm missing. So Ruby is a really very heavily OOP language. So understanding all those elements, understanding how to use modules is important. And I don't know, I guess I didn't want to dive too deep. I just wanted to be like, you should totally read a lot of articles about this stuff. And there's lots of good articles about that stuff out there. People talk about, for example, what's the difference between including something and prepending something? What's the difference between inheritance and composition? You should totally go read all those articles. And some of them are super deep and some of them are less deep, but they'll help you like pick it up, because there's a lot of nuance to figure out. Anyway, I've been talking for a while.
Yeah, but I think you've kind of talked through most of those issues, right? The other thing you need to understand with Ruby related to that is that you can in Ruby go look up the ancestor chain, right? You can see what it's going to look at first and second and third and fourth and fifth to look up what the method is going to use, right? You can look at, okay, I prepended or I included or I inherited, and, you know, and then add something in. You can actually do this in IRB, right? You can open the class and include a module and then pull the ancestor chain again and see what it did, right? And you can really get a good feel for this. It's not that terribly complicated, but what happens is a lot of times you'll wind up with a class that has several things in the inheritance chain or in the ancestor chain, and then it gets confusing. The other thing you need to understand is that there are hooks for inheritance, there are hooks for inclusion, and so you need to understand what kinds of assumptions people are going to make when you use their code in that way, right? And make sure that you're on top of those things as well. And if you understand those things and you understand how they kind of bolt together, you're going to save yourself a lot of headaches as far as just, okay, what is actually going on here?
Scope.
Now, what do you mean by scope?
Just scope in Ruby. It's not like we have a scope. It's different.
I think you mean like, for example, like variable scope, things like that.
I do. I mean the lexical varieties.
Well, there's different. Yes. Yeah. Okay, go.
Yeah.
Learn how it works. That's there we go.
Okay.
So the peculiar thing for me when I came in was the Ruby namespacing is very forgiving. So, and this is when I say scope, I mean scope and blocks. Mm-hmm. So I wrote some truly disgusting code last night and I felt good about it. And what I was doing was passing lines, and I had like my lines dot each do line, but that line was actually a bit JSON. So I passed it and that had an array in it. of lines. So then I said, my process lines dot each do line. So now I've got two lines in the same, nest of blocks. And what happens, to the line? Does the line get overwritten? No, it doesn't. It just becomes a totally different line. So you can reuse the same variable name throughout your kind of horrible chain of blocks with no issues. And Ruby will just go, oh, okay, it's this line now. Now we're in the block above. It's that line. Now, okay, I promise you,
kneecaps.
Right? I promise you, this happens more often than you think in people's code, because it's really, really natural when you're writing it to say, well, that's a line. That's a line. It's a line. Come on, or it's a fig. It's a foo. To reuse, especially the nested data structure, HTML being one of the main offenders, where everything's a div. So yeah, and new people coming in will be seriously confused because they will not be sure which line is the line. So there we go. Scope and blocks and the ability to use the same variable without overwriting the one right next to it.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if you come from JavaScript where closures are kind of a major feature of the language, you look at kind of the kind of scoping thing that Luke is talking about, and you realize that Ruby lets you get away with a ton of stuff that
so much stuff
like JavaScript don't.
So much stuff.
This is another example of a powerful feature that you could use for good, being that often is used to cut off your own hand or shoot yourself in the foot, however you want to think about it. RuboCop will help you identify some of these. Fantastic tool for helping you to notice things like this, right? Is a smell that you could have trouble down the road, right? So
yeah,
a great, so as we go farther down this, I might mention RuboCop or other tools again, right? Like there are a lot of cool tools out there that you should be aware of that will help you find the places in your code, not necessarily all of them, but a lot of them, where you're doing things like this and maybe you're doing it unintentionally, like Luke is talking about, and you'll get yourself into trouble.
The cop parted ways a long time ago, and we haven't spoken for a while. And quite frankly, that's the way I like it. Anytime anyone accuses me of having a code smell, then I use the E word. The E word when someone accuses you of having a code smell? Expressive. This is expressive code.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Yeah, as far as like naming nested variables the same thing, for me, it just makes it hard to read. And I think that's the complaint. But yeah, understanding, hey, this is in scope or out of scope, like I said, and then I think we've all said it, is that, Ruby lets you get away with a lot here. It's not nearly as unforgiving as some of the other languages out there. But yeah, you do have to be aware of it because it is something that does crop up and can come back around to cause you issues because you don't realize that you moved into another scope that, overlays the original scope. And then you do have a variable that has the same name and you're making the assumption that it's the original variable. And then you've got a problem. But
for science, caching and naming.
Yeah.
Too hard.
But the flip side is I don't know that this is as critical as some of the other ones that we brought up with metaprogramming or inheritance. I do have another one that I wanted to throw out and see what you guys thought. And that is that I feel like Rubyists all need to understand how to use a testing framework. I don't care if you're using RSpec or Minitest or something else, but you need to understand how to use a testing framework and you need to actually use the testing framework, right? We can argue over TDD or not TDD or whatever, but at the end of the day, you need to be testing your code and you need to be using a testing framework. And most tests, right? Because there's another rabbit hole too, right? With mocking and stubbing and test coverage and all that garbage. And I think there's a discussion to be had. And I think there's a fruitful discussion to be had where we could agree on probably 90% of what we talk about. But at the end of the day, you should be testing your code. And most tests are just a procedural list of run this, check this, run this, check this. And you don't have to get into all of the esoteric, should I mock this or not? Should I blah, blah, blah this? Do I need to use these advanced techniques? Test the basic easy stuff where the tests more or less write themselves and understand how your test framework actually does the work.
So testing is a cultural thing in Ruby, right? We do it. So yeah, you're going to work at a shop one day that does it. So you should definitely know how to do it. I would definitely agree. No matter what your particular stance is on it, right? Like, you're going to do it in your professional life unless you run solo the rest of it.
I was watching the most amazing video of that man with the BMW on YouTube, where he couldn't diagnose the fault and he thought the car might have been deliberately sabotaged because it was being repossessed. Someone had put eggs in the radiator. Have you heard of this? Putting eggs in the radiator and it clogs up the engine?
That would work.
Not writing tests is the software development equivalent of eggs in the radiator. If you hate your coworkers and you want to sabotage the next person who takes over your project, don't write tests.
Well, the myth is that tests take time and they, you know, you can move faster without doing the tests. And my experience is that when you start, especially if you don't have the practice of testing, it does take longer. I'm not going to blow smoke. It does, right? And it's an effort to learn it and get used to it. The other thing is there is some setup that goes into making sure that your tests are there and run when you're, you know, when you're getting started. Okay. So there is some overhead, right? Some people are like, well, it saves you all this time. And here's where it makes the difference. And it's also why it's hard to justify sometimes is because at the end of the day, you have tests. And so if your tests catch something, unless you're documenting, hey, the test caught this time, most people don't know what it actually saved them, right? They don't know when it saved them a bug showing up in prod, right? They don't know when it, you know, guided their coworker down a different path of writing the code because all of a sudden there's this other understanding of how the code works, right? So those things are kind of intangible, but that's where the savings come in. That's where the time comes in. And it also enables people to move fast because they're confident that the code does what they expect. And so to me, that's the payoff for testing. But I also understand that, yeah, you know, it's hard to measure the payoff for it. So at the end of the day, my point is that, you know, depending on what the costs and risks are, you know, testing may be critical or it may just allow you to move more quickly, but it almost always pays off. It's just initially it's going to be hard. It's not going to be fun. And, you know, it's the payoff's going to come down the road. And so you have to justify and understand it that way. But at the end of the day, too, I also feel like, hey, we're professionals. We're being paid to write code that does a specific job in a specific way for our employers. And we have a responsibility to make sure it works, and testing is a good way to do that.
Hey, folks, if you love this podcast and would like to support the show, or if you wish you could listen without the sponsorship messages, then you're in luck. We're setting up new premium podcast feeds where you can get all of the episodes released after Christmas 2020 without the ads. Signing up will help us pay for editing and production, and you can go sign up at devchat.tv/premium.
So this is a thing where I think people are, so I've been at places where I've had to make this argument and I'm very familiar with it, right? So I'm also kind of sympathetic I can empathize with the people who don't want to put tests, right? Like, I don't agree with it, but like, I understand where they're coming from. And I think I can address it pretty well. Like, at the end of the day, what you're trying to judge is, okay, so I know there's overhead required to get started testing, right? Both the overhead of setting it up and the overhead of, if you don't know how to do testing yet, me learning how to test with this thing that I set up, right? And the question is, how long is it until I get payoff? And is the time that it takes for me to get payoff too far out for me to, you know, make this time investment, right? And that's what you're trying to do. And we have concepts in like the financial world, right? To handle this, like how soon is it going to be till I pay my investment back, right? When do I get my ROI? When does my ROI achieve, you know, zero? And then I start actually making money. And one of the difficult things about programming is that this is super subjective, and it mostly comes from people who have been doing this for a long time, you know, shouting their opinions and just saying stuff. And, you know, as a Rubyist who's been doing this for a while, I mean, just going to be honest, like the payoff is probably a few weeks. Like, you're going to make your time investment back within a few weeks. It's not very long. So it's totally worth the switch. If you are writing an MVP that you are going to finish this weekend, maybe you don't need tests. But it, if it's not going to finish this weekend, if it's going to take two weekends or something, you're totally going to make your time investment back. Just switch to writing tests. It's totally worth it.
Those tests you write will be bad tests. There is a learning curve of knowing what to test. So, you know, and sometimes the first tests you see will be bad tests. But eventually you will hit some kind of problem. With me, it's usually billing related, where it's really knotty and you get burned and you're like, that's the thing we should have been testing. Mm-hmm. And then you put it in and you've got peace of mind that you'll never hit that problem again.
Bad tests in there. You're just going to be like, oh, it's another problem and I need to fix it. And I still am not going to write a test. One thing that I do try to, for people that like aren't quite ready to make the hurdle to get into testing, one thing that I find super easy to do, it's also my personal style as well, it, sort of. The easiest test to write is, hey, I have a bug in production. Let me write a failing test for that, fix my problem. And then now I have a test and I have, you know, a working code base, right? So whenever that is the one, that is, you know, a small implementation of TDD, right? That is really the only time that I use TDD in my own personal process. I tend to write tests after, but it's also the easiest test for somebody that's new to testing to write. Just write that failing test, fix your bug and push it, right? You'll all of a sudden be protected against that bug.
Yeah. And, you know, we're making the argument as to why you should be testing, but at the end of the day, I mean, to John's point, I mean, it's a powerful tool just to verify that your bugs are fixed and that they don't recur, right? If nothing else, right? You just use it for that. It's a powerful tool for that. And, you know, it's just another reason to know how to use the testing frameworks and how they work.
Now, RSpec's not the only thing. When I started doing RSpec, then because of the all of the it statements, then it just kept giving me flashbacks to Silence of the Lambs. You know, it kind of puts the lotion in the basket. And every time I see it, I always think of Hannibal Lecter. So if you use Minitest, you don't have to get triggered by that.
Low person, right, that isn't testing yet, and you're not making that decision, you're probably going to go work on a team somewhere that is writing tests. So just knowing how to write tests from a practical standpoint will help you get jobs, good jobs, you know, in the Ruby community and keep them and be a good contributor to your team.
Yep.
And your teammates won't hate you for being the one person on the team that doesn't write tests.
Well, what I found is that a lot of teams, they'll adopt the practice and then it essentially becomes mandated, right? You're not going to be the jerk that's not writing tests, because if you do that for long enough, they're going to say, look, it's our team practice. It's part of the job. And so if you don't want to do the job, then go find another one.
This is true, but I was thinking about that person that like is like skirting the line, right? And they're like putting the minimum amount of tests to satisfy whatever like sort of condition like people have set, whether it's like, oh, we have a threshold for tests, right? Or somebody's like, go write tests for this thing. And so they write minimal tests to cover it so that it gets through code review and the one person is satisfied, but they're continually building up negative, you know. You know, you don't want to be that person. Like, don't be building negative rapport with your team. Otherwise, somebody will hopefully eventually talk to you about that. And just don't do that.
Well, the other thing is in my opinion, a good boss will pick up on that and say, look, you're either in or you're not. Right? Everybody else is pulling their weight and you're not. And a good boss will actually make a hard call. And I hate to sound like I'm advocating that somebody get fired. But if the team has decided that that's the way they're going to do things and somebody else decides that they're not going to go along with it, then they need to find a new team. Yeah, but that's more an attitude thing, I guess, than a practice thing. So I'm curious what else is in there. I have like three or four more things, but I'm curious what other things you have on your list of things that Rubyists need to know.
My major one, besides the OOP one, is functional programming. There's a lot of functional Ruby provides a lot of functional things in it, and learning to use those tools.
But you said it was OOP. I'm confused, John.
Yeah, I did. And you know what? Ruby is also a first-class functional language. It's one of only a handful of languages that really like fits this bill. And it's really cool that you can be fully OOP or fully functional or mix and match. That's one of the awesome things that I personally love about Ruby, is because I think that OOP works better for certain applications By applications, I mean, I'm sorry, certain use cases, and functional programming works better for other use cases. So I like to mix and match. And I love that about Ruby. I mean, so one of the most obvious things that you probably already use if you've done any Ruby at all, right, is enumerable. Enumerable is obviously OOP, right? You're iterating over an object and you're basically passing it to a function and you write that function somewhere. Now, it could be a block. You could be doing it inline. You know, you're probably familiar with doing that. You can actually pass it a method if you want. You know, you just turn your method into a block. There's a lot of things that you can do, but you're doing functional stuff right there. There are libraries out there in Ruby that help you to make your data immutable and things. I'll try to find that before the end of the show so we can like link that or whatever. There's a bunch of them, but I'll put one in there. There's a lot of things that you can do in Ruby if you like kind of want to go purely functional and write your entire app functional style. One thing that probably most people are familiar with but aren't necessarily thinking of is functional service objects or jobs. They both tend to be places in your, or like thinking Rails here, right? So they both tend to be places in your code where you've said, you know, this really isn't an OOP object per se, but it is, I'm trying to encapsulate a process of some kind, right? So you're writing a process and you're just encapsulating that process in the object, and your object contains your process. And then when you run your processor, you're performing functional stuff in there, right? So I think one of the difficult conversations that keeps happening in the Ruby community is, should I use service objects or should I not? A lot of people are actually just using service objects as a big junk drawer, which is not actually functional. So, you know, that doesn't fit my argument. But when you're putting stuff in there that are processes, you're encapsulating functional stuff. So there's a understanding functional programming will totally help you get a lot more power out of Rails. I'm sorry, Ruby. It might help you get more power out of Rails too. But it really will help you get more power in Ruby. It'll just help you leverage the tools that the language already gives you, you know, to encapsulate good chunks of your code that fit that thing. I'm a huge fan of Ruby from a functional standpoint. But like we said earlier in the night, like Ruby totally lets you shoot yourself in the foot. And one of the things with functional programming is that you have certain expectations, or you need to act in a certain way, right? Your data can't be mutable. If you're changing your data in the middle of your processes, for example, right, then you're not functionally programming. So Ruby will let you break the box that you put yourself in, like, very easily. So if you want to do functional style programming in Ruby, you have to kind of make a conscious decision that that's what you're going to do. Otherwise, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm going to back up to kind of the second point that you were making. Enumerable was on my list. And the reason is because we deal with collections all the time. That's one of the things in programming. We're dealing with data. Data usually comes in collections or lists or things like that. And so you have to fight through that. And understanding enumerable and how that kind of all bolts together is going to save you lots of pain. And it's also going to empower you to do a whole bunch of things that you probably didn't know that it did, right? Like inject or collect or reject or something else act. I mean, they're all acts, but you know, you get the idea, right? You know, just doing a fast map or collect, right? Select. That was the other one I was looking for, because it's select and reject. But yeah, I mean, it's going to save you so much effort because Ruby already has that functionality.
Monkey patches.
Ooh, we're going to open this door, huh?
I am. This is where we're talking about things people need to know. They need to know about the monkeys.
That's fair. I always have just classified this. What?
Flying monkeys.
Oh, I've always just classified this as like being part of understanding how classes work. But yeah, I mean, it is a very special thing. So tell us, Luke, how's it work?
So I've got a couple of theories on this. But what is a monkey patch? A monkey patch is something that could exist anywhere in your code base. There's a few lines that could be anywhere in the project. And these lines can do literally anything. And my favorite is to completely change or modify the behavior of a fundamental part of a language, like a string. So using a monkey patch, you can make every string everywhere in your code get capitalized. And there's nothing any other method can do about it. It will happen. It could be anywhere in any module and any method. You can monkey patch anything from anywhere in Ruby. It's the total opposite of things like Java, which bend over backwards to stop rogue code changing other bits of the code. Ruby lets you patch anything from anywhere. And the reason it's called a monkey patch is, I think, because of the idea of a monkey wrench that is a very flexible tool.
Yeah. So longtime listeners of this show will remember David Brady. And David's a good friend of mine. We used to be neighbors, actually. And if you, a longtime Rubyist, will also remember Ruby Koans. Did you guys ever do Ruby Koans? So basically, it was a set of exercises where they would give you tests and you would have to write the code that made the test pass, right? And so the challenge that David put it to was to monkey patch the Ruby that was being called in the tests to make the test pass without modifying the code that it was supposed to be testing, right? So he was essentially monkey patching the testing library and the Ruby core libraries in order to make the test pass by essentially messing up Ruby. Okay. And so that's the kind of power you have in there. And he got a long ways down the road of it, right? And he showed it to Matt's, and Matt's just laughed his head off because he thought it was funny, right? But I mean, that's the power we're talking about here. And, you know, to your point, Luke, the problem is yeah, you can monkey patch from anywhere. And so if you monkey patch something and you don't do it in a place where people are expecting to find it, then it becomes really, really hard to start to debug that. And so
my favorite is when you make true 99.7% of the time and then false the other 0.03%.
Ooh, that sounds fun. But the flip side is, as far as like this being a feature that you need to know, and my initial reaction was, no, you don't need to understand monkey patching. But I will tell you, it's a really powerful feature when you're trying to figure out what code does, because you can monkey patch some of the stuff around it. It's somewhat similar to like test stubbing. So you can monkey patch the methods that the method you're trying to figure out calls. So you can see what gets thrown into it. You can monkey patch other things. You can monkey patch the libraries that you're using to try and figure them out, or just to eliminate them as problem areas. Sometimes I've monkey patched stuff, you know, on a running Rails app or Ruby app just to get more information. And so it's a really, really handy tool if, you know, you don't want to go all the way into, say, a Pry or a Rails console to get information really quickly.
A monkey patch on C. And evolved from there. So that's my monkey patch origin theory of Ruby.
We'll get Matt to confirm that for you.
This is obviously an easy to shoot yourself in the foot tool, right?
Oh, but, yeah.
Like, you can, I mean, I would argue that almost every Rails project has some of this, right? Because, you know, you start off, especially legacy Rails projects, right? You start off your app and everything's fine, cool, dandy. You maybe go to upgrade Rails or something and, you know, a gem doesn't work. And I would argue that like 50% of the time people fix, you know, a broken gem during an upgrade with a monkey patch. Not always, but, you know, that's like a really common way to do it. Or one thing that, I mean, I do this, right? Like it's really common to have a lib extensions folder under your Rails project, right? Where you're like, well, I want to add this method to the string class or the hash class or something, right? If you, one that I occasionally do, I'm trying to remember it off the top, Deep Compact, right? Which got removed from active support a while back. Like there are occasionally apps where I do so much like compacting that I actually want to create my own like Deep Compact or whatever. And so I put that in there. I think it's Deep Compact or whatever. They got removed. Anyway, there's something that I occasionally use that's like that. There are occasionally times when you're just like, well, I want this to be available to all of my objects of this type. And it's a core Ruby thing. That's fine for this app. That's cool. You just, you know, it, when you're doing this monkey patching, you just probably want to make sure it's like really obvious what you're doing and that, you know, you make sure to pass that knowledge on to the other members of your team or the people that come after you, things like that. Just like metaprogramming, it should be a conscious choice. You know that what you're doing is not the most obvious. So you need to make sure that that is a particular thing that you call out when you're onboarding somebody. That's like one of the most important things for somebody new to learn.
Yep, absolutely. So here's one, and this is, I guess, a little bit outside of the Rails realm. In fact, I think we should just do another episode, and this is like non-Ruby things that Rubyists should know, right? Or skills that they should have, because I wanted to bring up things like Rubyists should understand how to deploy their apps, which kind of gets more into DevOps and, you know, somewhat less into Rails or Ruby or whatever. There's some Ruby knowledge there, but there's a lot of non-Ruby knowledge, right? Same thing with, you really need to understand how to use your text editor, right? Or your IDE, because you're going to move faster doing that kind of a thing. And so we'll just do another episode on that, because I think those are open doors there. One other thing within Ruby, though, that came to mind and has really benefited me over the years, especially having known James Edward Gray for as long as I have, is that he had this like encyclopedic knowledge of the core Ruby core libraries. And I'm not saying you have to know them all, because I don't use them all. In fact, there are several things in Ruby core that I never touch, right? But there are a handful of kind of the fundamental classes or data types that I use all the time, right? And so as a Rubyist, I need to understand what those data types are and how they work, right? So things like fixNum or bigint, you've got string. I'm trying to think what other ones, regex, just stuff like that, right? There are a whole bunch of them in there, you know. Some of the other ones like CSV or set or some of those, you really only need them if you're actually using them in your particular app. But, you know, there are a handful of those really fundamental ones that really come in handy. You know, there's the HTTP and the net classes, right? Net HTTP, net DNS, net, you know, those are handy to know. And so just getting into the core libraries and understanding those really pays off. Understanding hash, array, you know, and the things that are added to those outside of enumerable, right? Again, just you open up so much stuff just by knowing what's there and knowing how it works.
This, from my perspective, right? So you're like talking about understanding all the core libraries. One of the things that I feel like is fundamentally important as a Ruby developer is to have a basic knowledge of gems that are available to you. Now, you can't know all the, just like you can't know everything in the core library, like there's the rare person that you think basically knows all of them, right? But I look up enumerable like all the time. Like that's one of the most common pages that I go to, even though I'm super familiar with it. But in the same way,
you know where to go, right? You're familiar enough with it to know what you're looking for and how to find it quickly.
And that's exactly what I'm going to say about gems, right? Like in the same way, having a basic understanding of what gems are available to you, you know, is very helpful, but you're not going to know all the gems that are available to you. So one thing to do is to know where to go to find a gem that maybe you want, right? I have two things that I care about here. One is Ruby gems, and the other is Awesome Ruby, which is just a list of Ruby gems that is pretty awesome. It's just a community managed list. It literally is like, hey, here's some good gems for like this category, right? For, you know, authorization. Here's a good list of gems for, you know, creating an admin panel in your Rails app. Here's a good list of gems for, you know, like all sorts of categories of stuff. Yeah, Ruby gems kind of does that too, but I feel like Awesome Ruby is kind of a community curated list that's pretty good. It's a huge list, but it's pretty good at narrowing down to like kind of both the most popular plus like people saying, hey, here's my comments. This gem is like maybe really old or something, right? Or this gem does this a little bit better. But yeah, knowing where to go to find your gems, right? And having a basic idea of maybe what exists out there that you could take advantage of.
It's interesting. I hadn't seen this one. The one I'm familiar with is Ruby Toolbox. It's ruby-toolbox.com. And it has...
I would pick it. Like, I've always felt like it's really good.
Yeah, there's definitely good stuff here. I'm going to have to dive in and have a look. But yeah. Yeah, and it looks like they've got lists for a whole bunch of other stuff too. Android, C++, Crystal, Elixir, Go, Haskell, iOS. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll definitely link that for us.
Yep. Good deal. Anything else before we go to picks? I think we're kind of getting around that time. So
my major things have been hit up.
Yeah, I think we hit mine too. I think the only other, you know, again, it's down to like design patterns is another one that came up. But again, you know, that's language specific, but it's something, again, that developers in general just need to be familiar with.
I'm gonna throw one final thing out there, which is, again, something which tripped me up at the beginning. which is that features are very much dependent on the version of Ruby. And I kind of started during 1.8, 1.9 transition, right? And the whether or not you've got Rails loaded, so active support. So quite a lot of the cool things, quite a lot of the answers on Stack Overflow are going to be using these cool methods, which are very dependent on the version of Ruby that you are using. All of these convenience features are not stable. They are constantly being introduced to Ruby. So it's not like C or Python where they don't tend to add new keywords that often. Ruby is always adding new stuff. For example, I used to have to use regular expressions, but now I don't have to use them anymore because Ruby 2.5 adds the start underscore with question mark method, which is the only thing I really used regular expressions for. So now I can just rename everything to start with. But supposing I'm sitting on a computer which doesn't have Ruby 2.5, I'm going to have a bad time until I realize that a lot of these methods, especially the ones for convenience, like the kind of days ago stuff in Rails, part of the core language, and they vary hugely depending on what version of Rails or Ruby you're using.
Yep, absolutely. It's interesting too, because I guess the active support is something that you need to be aware of, especially if you spend a lot of time in Rails. Because I've had that bite me before, where it's like, oh, is that a Rails only or an active support only feature? Yep.
I would argue it's super useful when you're outside of Rails, right? Like to know what's in active support, because then you're like, do I really want to, I want to write this easy method, do I really want to write it myself or do I just want to include active support? And I mean, active support, you can include specific modules very easily. So it requires specific modules. So it's really easy to just be like, you know what? I just want this one method. Let me just grab it.
Yep. I've run into that before as well. And making the decision to, because ultimately code is down to communication, right? You're communicating with the machine. I think everybody gets that part of it. But you're also communicating with other programmers. And so if you're pulling in a specific module out of active support, then you've got to make sure that everybody understands that they're not getting all of active support. And you've also got to, in my opinion anyway, be able to justify why you pulled in this module or why you didn't pull in the whole thing or why you didn't just implement the couple of methods that you needed or things like that, because there are trade-offs to those. Active support's pretty well tested. It's pretty well understood. So there aren't major downsides to pulling it in. But, if this is code that you're shipping somewhere and, you want to keep it lean and mean, pulling in a whole module for active support may be more than you want. So you just have to understand what it all means.
Okay. Yeah. So like all programming languages, right? Understanding the trade-offs of what you're doing is really important, right? Because I think there's a lot of trip ups around gems, especially. There are plenty of people that advocate, oh, well, you should keep your gem file as small as possible, right? And then, all of a sudden they're writing all this custom code and not all of it's all that important and they have to maintain all of it. Maybe they don't have expertise, right? To be writing their own. I mean, I worked at a place where they wrote their own auth system and they wrote a portion of this auth stuff that didn't do what, they wanted it to do. And because they didn't have the expertise in-house to recognize the fact that they weren't achieving their goal, like they had a vulnerability in there that they weren't watching it. They didn't have like a security focused person in-house that was just reading security articles every day and like just had that knowledge, right? To be like, this is a huge hole, right? Whereas, pulling in Devise or something or whatever, just automatically get, there's people that are writing Devise that have a lot more expertise than you do, for example, right? They're paying attention to that stuff. They make sure to submit PRs when security vulnerabilities come out. So if you're not walking around with that expertise, that's probably something that you want to pull in, for example, right? The point is that you just saying, oh, I want to make my gem file as small as possible isn't always the right choice. I'm just going to get a library for everything also has hiccups, right? You have a huge bloated gem file. As soon as you want to update to the latest version of Rails, like you've got to go through every single gem and update them or drop some of them because some of them won't be available for the next version of Rails and things. Like you should understand the trade-offs of your app, and you should make decisions that make sense. And you should be really careful about just, you know, hooking on to some ideal and just running with it, because you're, if you're not paying attention to the downsides of that ideal.
Yep, absolutely. All right. Well, I think we've covered most of our bases here. I am curious, though, if anybody listening to this is like, hey, you missed this thing, right? If there's something else that we didn't talk about, that you feel like we should have covered, leave us a comment, because I'd love to do a part two and kind of go, hey, people pointed out these six things, and these four we definitely agree with, and these other two, you know, Chuck doesn't think you need to know this one, but John really does think you need to know this one, and we can have that conversation, right? And see where we all kind of come out on this stuff. But for the most part, it's been interesting to see that we all generally agree on, hey, you've got to have these pieces in place and understand these things that are going on in the world of Ruby.
Hey, folks, I don't know if you've noticed, but I've been working a lot on figuring out how to help people become the most valuable developers on their teams, or becoming the top 5% of developers in the field. If you're looking to level up, figure out how to contribute more, get the career you want, get the career that you want that will support the lifestyle you want, then you should check out the Most Valuable Dev Summit. I've invited some of my friends across the community, people that you've heard of, people that have worked on systems that you use on a daily basis, people who have invented new ways of doing things over the years in programming, and I've asked them one question, and that question is, how do you become a top 5% developer? How do you become 1 in 20 of the best developers out there? And so we're going to go ahead and have that conversation with them in interviews on the Most Valuable Dev Summit. And you can find that at summit.mostvaluable.dev.
But let's do picks. John, do you want to start us off with picks this week?
First thing I'm going to pick is Trailblazer. So I talked earlier about kind of functional programming stuff. So Trailblazer is both a framework unto itself, as well as, like, I mean, it's a collection of gems, right? Like, used together, they have some really cool things that they can do. But you can also just be like, you know what, I just want to use cells, or I just want to use, you know, the whatever the form one is. I don't remember off the top of my head. And I already closed the web page. But I put, yep, okay. So, I mean, you can pick and choose which gems you want to use. But the reason why I picked this is because a long time ago, when I was looking for like some functional things to add to an app that I was working on, like I ran across Trailblazer, and it's super, super influenced by functional style. And there's like various gems tools in here that let you basically do things in your app that are more functionally styled than, for example, Rails is. Rails has a tendency to kind of be well away from that. So Trailblazer is totally a thing that, you know, you may want to pick and choose. That I've always done that. I'm a picker and chooser. Like I said earlier, I like to mix and match for my various use cases that make sense to me. That's how I've always used Trailblazer, and that's how I would recommend it to people. But it's high quality, and it's been around for a long time, and the community that uses it has always been like super responsive, and you know, they maintain it super well. So great framework for that kind of side of Ruby. If you wanted something like, if you just wanted immutable objects or things like that, you can find things out, all sorts of libraries out there to do that kind of stuff. Okay, so that's my first pick. And my second pick is, we were kind of talking earlier about, like, we were talking earlier in the show about steaks and meat and things like that. And I was just reminded of the fact that, you know, you want to, if you want to get meat, like, my experience has always been, find yourself a local butcher. So that's my second pick, right? Go find yourself a local butcher. That's the best way to get like beef or whatever, more or less. And sometimes pork, though. I live in a state that overproduces on pork, so I feel like it's everywhere, and I get good cuts at my store or whatever, but I don't feel like I get good cuts of beef at my store. So the local butcher is the right place for me to get that.
Yeah, definitely. I'm going to throw out a few picks here. I skipped Luke. I'm going to make Luke go first.
So it's been Easter on the last weekend, and I spent the whole of Easter rebuilding old server hardware, rack mount server hardware. It was great. The pandemic's really getting those server rebuilding hours in. And my picks, therefore, are, firstly, getting free stuff. It's loads of free stuff. Just have to ask. Got loads of free servers. Just asking people, ask around if you need computing hardware or similar things. You know, there's a community of people out there. You can go on Facebook. You can get free stuff really easily. My second pick is deleting your data before you give free stuff away. Don't leave your data on computers that you give away. Make sure you wipe your hard drives. And my third pick, which is a really weird one, is putting resistors on computer fans. So I've got a whole load of computers here. They're all really noisy. And I thought, yeah, no BIOS control, of course, no way to control the fans. The fans are critical. You can't turn the fans off. You can't unplug them, or the server will fail to boot. But what you can do is you can cut the 12-volt power wire to the fan and put a resistor in between the power supply and the fan. Now, this and the magic value of the resistor is not 42 ohms, but 47 ohms, apparently. But 42 ohms would do, and you can use variable resistors. This comes with a slight caveat, though, and for legal reasons, I must advise you not to make your servers very quiet and smooth by adding resistors to your fans, because fans are a fairly safety critical part of the server. This is why the server won't turn on without the fans, is because server gets very hot if fans don't work. And if you were to insert a resistor between the power supply and your very noisy data center fan, that resistor might get awfully hot. And I'm talking really, really hot. So high risk, high reward, adding resistors to your computer or server's fans.
Fan controllers as well, that are a little less of a fire hazard, but more expensive.
Nice. All right, I'm going to throw out some picks. First of all, I started a new podcast. You're welcome. The podcast is the Dev Influencers Show, and that's at devinfluencers.com/podcast. This goes along with the Dev Influencers Accelerator, where I'm helping people accelerate their careers by building podcasts. And I'm just talking about some of the things that people can do to build an audience and serve that audience, and then how that will help you get the, you know, wherever you want to go in your career. And anyway, I released it on Wednesday, the first episode. And so, but I've recorded like 7 episodes. I'm going to record a whole bunch more tonight, tomorrow. But it's a daily show. Their episodes are 10 to 20 minutes. And I'm telling stories and talking about how to do specific things. And some of it's pretty hands-on stuff. Like one of the episodes is how to choose a podcasting mic. But some of the other ones are more sort of, okay, if this is where you want to go, or here's how you figure out where you want to go, then, you know, here's what you do. And anyway, I'm really, really digging it. I've gotten a lot of good feedback about episode 1. And so I'm just going to put out there, yeah, that is something that we're working on. That's at devinfluencers with an S, devinfluencers.com/podcast. And then if you're interested in the accelerator, you can go check it out at devinfluencers.com/apply. And so, yeah, I'm pretty excited about that. I have 2 other picks, and they're both films, both movies. So, and I do get crap when I tell people that I go out and, you know, eat at restaurants and see movies and stuff, but I go out and eat at restaurants and see movies and stuff. So my wife and I went out on Monday. We've both had COVID, so we feel like we're pretty safe. But anyway, what we wind up doing is we wound up going to Olive Garden for dinner, which was fun. But then we went and saw a movie, and the movie, it's actually about a British guy. So it was funny. He would talk, and I would think of Luke. But yeah, and the main character is played by Benedict Cumberbatch. And anyway, it's called The Courier. And it's a spy movie, not like James Bond spy, but like actual stuff that actually happened spy movie. So it's more about tradecraft and stuff like that than it is about, you know, people jumping through windows and shooting guns and gizmos and stuff. But the idea is, and you can watch the trailer and it'll tell you, but basically in the 1960s, they were looking for a way. So there was a high level Soviet officer that was looking to pass information to the West. And so they recruited this salesman from Britain, and he basically set up a bunch of business in Moscow and would travel back and forth. And his main contact there, what turned out to be this Russian officer. And so this Russian officer was passing intelligence back to the West through this salesman. And it tells this story, and you're sitting there, you know, through this whole thing, you know, and trying to figure out, okay, are they going to get caught? Are they, you know? But anyway, I'm not going to spoil how it all goes, because my personal policy is if it hasn't been out for a year, I don't get to spoil it. And this movie definitely hasn't been. But it was really, really great. And it kind of gives you a little bit more information about how the West got certain information that they acted on in some of the big confrontations that occurred between the USSR and the US, the USA. And so anyway, that's all I'm really going to say about it. But it was a terrific movie. And so I'm going to pick that. And then last night, my father-in-law was here and we were chatting, and then we were looking for something to watch on Amazon Prime and ran into a documentary called No Safe Spaces. And it talks a lot about free speech and what free speech means and whether or not certain speech should be controlled and stuff like that. And I thought it was a really thought-provoking documentary just on, hey, you know, what is okay to say? What is okay to suppress? Should the government be suppressing it? How do we react to this stuff? And anyway, I really, really enjoyed it. So if you're looking for a movie that will, and by movie, I mean a documentary that'll make you think about, okay, you know, what is free speech and, you know, what should we allow or disallow, or should we allow all of it or things like that? I mean, I have my own opinions. I'm deliberately not speaking them out, but this was a movie that really kind of drove home some of those things. And what's interesting is the guys that put it together, they talked to a bunch of people that they didn't agree with, right, about some of this stuff, and asked some pretty poignant questions that, again, you know, hearing people with an opinion that was different from mine, you know, that was expressed, you know, either as the documentarians or as the guests, again, really made me think, okay, you know, what is the point here? What are we thinking about? What is the, you know, what are the trade-offs? And so anyway, I really enjoyed it. I like movies that make me think. And that was definitely one of them. So No Safe Spaces is that pick.
Americans and your amendments. In Britain, we just asked the Queen what we should think.
Oh, well, see, that's easy. So those are my picks. But yeah, anything else that we should cover before we jump off? All right. Well, thank you both for being here and sharing your thoughts. We'll go ahead and wrap up. Until next time, folks, Max out.
Bandwidth for this segment is provided by CacheFly, the world's fastest CDN. Deliver your content fast with CacheFly. Visit CacheFly.com to learn more.